All right, before we go to the first panel this afternoon, John Corcoran's going to speak to us. He was going to follow David Bolton this morning. Of course, we had to go to lunch, so let's now welcome John Corcoran.
This is doing a five-minute interview on CNN. I have about 50 years of life experience I want to give to you in about 5 minutes. I want to, first of all, thank the teachers for being here. They are the most important people in all the world. And it's critical that we support them. But everybody in this room is a teacher of some sort. I'm a teacher. I was a teacher in the classroom for 17 years. And I am now a teacher on the bridge. And I was excited about being here today because this bridge idea that we're going to bring the practitioners together with the research, because we have plenty of research that tells us how to teach little boys and little girls like me how to read, write, and spell. About 25% of the population in this country learns to read like birds learn to fly. And about 25% or 30% of the population has difficulty learning to read. And I was in that spectrum. I live there. I still live there. But I crossed the bridge. I suspect in this room, the majority of the people walked by the library and got it. So we kind of maybe have a cultural gap here in me trying to articulate some of these things. From my perspective as an adult, I learned to read at the age of 48. A 65-year-old volunteer tutor at the Carlsbad Library sat down with me for 13 months and helped me understand that there was a code. She didn't really teach me the code because later on, Pat Lindemood taught me the code. But she did help me understand that the language had a system, and she could teach me that system. And I got about half of it. I got about the sixth grade level. I couldn't read. I could read about a newspaper. I could spell, couldn't write. But my appetite was wet. And I found Pat Lindemood. I went through a diagnostic test with her and identified a severe auditory discrimination problem. Spent 100 hours with her one summer. And I went from the second grade nonsense phonetic word attack skills to the 12th grade level. I didn't need any research to tell me that that worked. But Pat and I became friends. And I wanted the world to know that Pat knew what she was doing. And she said, John, we got to wait for the research to validate what we're doing. So patiently, she convinced me that research is very, very important, especially for you policymakers. You got to have that validation. And so as an advocate, not only did I learn to read, but I learned to greatly respect research. And I started out by telling you that I love teachers, and I truly do. I just want you to do the best job you can possibly do. I think illiteracy in America is a form of child neglect and child abuse. And David did a beautiful job today with the pictures, and it's too bad we didn't get to see more of it. And I'd never seen that before. And I was thinking, how could David know how to film that? And that's the way I think and feel. Those little children, I was a child that couldn't read. I was a teenager that couldn't read. I was a high school graduate that couldn't read. I was a college graduate that couldn't read. I was a teacher for 17 years that couldn't write a sentence, couldn't read, write, or spell my native language. And we carry the shame and the blame. And we are suspended, adults in America, are suspended in our childhood, emotionally, psychologically, spiritually, intellectually. Just like David was saying, we're locked into it. We're trapped. And we're desperate. Sometimes people ask me, how's it feel to beat the system? And I got to tell them, I never beat the system. An adult that can't read never beats the system. They're beat by the dominant literate society every single day, from the time they're in the third grade to the time they go to the grave. That's what happens. And a country that can send a camera to the moon, to Mars, and send a picture back ought to be able to teach all its people how to read and write and spell. And we have now the research that directs us. We have the prescription. We didn't have all this knowledge when I was a child. I can forgive my second grade teacher for not teaching me. She didn't know. She didn't know any better. And there was a place for me. There was a place for me on the farm or the ranch or in a factory for people that couldn't read. There is no place for an adult. We can't even get on the information highway. So I'm going as fast as I can. If my wife were here, she'd say, speed it up. You don't have much time, boy. That's another thing. When people will ask me, do you have a learning disability? And I kind of pause because my experience was I just couldn't read. And I was dumb. And I bought into a big lie that something was wrong with my brain because I went to school. And when I was at home for the first 6 years of my life, my mother and father told me I was a winner. I was the only boy in a family of five girls. I was a winner. And I went to school, and by the time I got to the second grade, it was very clear to me, they had a different, my mom and daddy never talked to them because they didn't know how to measure me because I ended up in the dumb row, that little boy. That little innocent boy ended up in the dumb row and didn't know how he got there and didn't know how to get out. Just like those little children we saw on the screen a little while ago. That's why I decided to tell my story, to come out and tell my story. It's an embarrassing story that I learned to read when I was 48 years old. I was so full of joy, but I was also really intimidated. I didn't want to hurt anybody's feelings. I don't want to hurt anybody's feelings today. I don't want to hurt any teacher's feelings today. I also feel like I'm kind of walking on eggs sometimes because teachers are so battered from so many different places. And all I'm asking you to do is not to give up on us. And I know that the people in this room haven't given up. They still are searching. And I want to tell you, we got some answers. We do have some answers. And I guess for the researchers, I want the researchers, can you guys figure out a way to get some other people to read that research you're coming up with? Because it doesn't seem like you're reading it. I'm going to try to accelerate this by reading two poems. And if this sounds like a commercial, first of all, I've written two books now. The first one, teachers always kind of dip down a little bit, was a teacher who couldn't read. And I'm sorry, but that's really, that opened a lot of doors for me. It has a double-edged blade, you know. Teachers get bashed. The last thing they want to hear is a teacher, one of their colleagues that couldn't read. I mean, it's bad enough without that kind of publicity. And the other book is A Bridge to Literacy. And there's a lot of holes in my story, and I'm sure some of you are asking, how could I do it? And I guess I could tell you I did it because, and I think most of you know this, you know we're not dumb. We think we're dumb, but some of you think we're not dumb. Dyslexics or a learning disabled, and learning disabled. Are you learning disabled? And I want to, now hold on, teachers. I want to say this with love. I want to say this, but I don't think I was learning disabled in this sense. I learned how to build houses. I learned how to read blueprints. I learned my timetables on time. I could count money and make change before I went to school. I learned to be polite, even though I may have ants in my pants. I think they call it ADD today. But I did learn, and part of it is, of course, I was very fortunate, and not all children have this gift of having a mother and father and telling you, you are a winner. And if a parent doesn't have, or a child doesn't have that at home, you, as the educators, have to say it with authority and confidence that you are a winner, and I can teach you how to read, because I know how to teach you to read. And if you don't know, find out, okay? Okay, a couple poems. The Native Alien. I do want to tell you, maybe I had some teachers with teaching disability. Too many teachers. That was kind of light. Come on. native alien here from there. You can be found everywhere. Going through the motions, showing your emotions. Native alien, you are lame. And literate society plays its games. They still keep looking for someone to blame. Isn't that a shame? Don't they have any idea of our pain? It seems so plain. They keep looking for someone to blame. What a national shame. They give us our promotions, and they put us through the motions. Bluebirds here, redbirds there. Now we have jailbirds everywhere. Oh, how we tried. Oh, how we cried. We were just past five, and how we had to hide. Oh, how we had to hide. Oh, how they stole our pride. Oh, how they lied. Native alien here from there, native alien everywhere. Shame, shame, we can't read, and how this nation bleeds. But they still will not heed why Johnny, the native alien, still can't read. Oh, how we tried. Oh, how many times has he died? Literate society, you can't hide. Oh, literate society, how come you lie? Scapegoat, cover up, alibi too. Oh, literate society, shame on you. Oh, literate society, you can't hide. Illiterate statistics have your hide. Why you choke on your own pride. Native alien, he can't read. It limits him. We concede. But he has ideas, concepts, and theories too. And that's the stuff of thought that you ought to concede to. Now, that was the first poem that I ever wrote. That was the first thing that I ever wrote as an adult when I went through the program. And when I learned to read, I was so happy. I was so full of joy. I wanted to find my third grade teacher and tell her I got it. And then I also got some anger that was stuffed for my survival real deep. And it started coming up. And I had to deal with it. I was angry. I was so full of joy because I learned to read when I was 48 years old, or I started to learn to read. I got to tell you, it took me about 7 years to learn to read. And then it took me additional 3 years that I could tell my wife that I didn't feel dumb anymore. That's a 58-year-old man that has been married to the same woman for 43 years, has children and grandchildren, has a successful business, still feeling dumb because I couldn't do something a third grader could do. I want to tell you who wrote this poem. It was the little boy, the innocent little boy. And when I did go to decide to speak, I spoke to that little boy, that little innocent little boy, and I asked him if I should speak to the rest of you. Now, I'm saying this. You guys know. You talk in the car to yourselves? Yes? You answer? Well, I had these conversations. I talked to this little sub-personality, and he said, I said, shall I go do it? And he said, go for it. Tell the big people. They won't hurt us anymore. We can learn to read. Go tell them. And then the native alien, he also was in this poet here. He said, don't bother. He's the kid that was suspended from school. He's a kid that was expelled from school in the seventh grade, spent most of his time in the hallway, spit on a teacher. Teachers made him cry. He made them cry. And that's the native alien. And that's who wrote this poem. And so when I first started reading it, there was a pretty sharp edge on my anger and rage and frustration. The native alien said, don't bother. Don't bother with them. They didn't care then. They don't care now. Don't expose us. Don't do it. It's too risky. But the little boy, the children, just like the same impact they have on you, you know, I'm going. And I told the native alien, he's going to behave himself. And he's not going to get me in any more trouble. And he got me in a lot of trouble, both as a teenager and an adult, as a man, because that just goes with you. And the little boy, my wife said, why don't you just shut up and read? And she did. But, you know, when you're married for a long time, you just sort of phrase the question in another way. I think it's called, in research, you form another hypothesis or something. Do more research, I guess, is what I was doing. Anyway, I wanted to let you know that that was an angry poem. And when I first started reading, I read it to teachers. I quit reading it for a while because I needed to really, truly forgive the real and imagined teachers that didn't teach me to read. And I thought, you know, the native alien thought you guys were conspiring against me. And as I healed, I know that none of my teachers wanted to ruin my life by not teaching me to read. But it was a process, and I think adults When we teach people to read in a spiritual sense, I was asked, Oprah asked me, what is the difference? Why did you tell this story? I said, one of the problems I had, I lied about who I was. And there was when I learned to read, it filled a big hole in my soul spiritually because I got to tell the truth. And telling that truth, I'm going to get this poem out. Telling that truth really filled a hole in my soul. And I think if America decides to teach its children and all its children and all its people to read, write, and spell, they're going to fill a big hole in our soul also. It won't solve all the social and economic problems, but it will help. I want to leave you with this too. It is as important to teach an adult how to read as it is to teach a child to read. Did you hear it? Do you believe it? You can't advocate for an adult if you don't believe that in your bones, in your heart. And it's never too late to learn. Okay, reading words is quite a gain, and I'm not about to complain. But I am obligated to explain some of our pain without casting any blame. We all have something to gain. Childhood memories ring clear in our ears, and images of failures are still very near. Oh, how we still fear that abandonment is near. Why we still fear is because of what we still hear. Label, label, label. Learning disabled. Let's put all the cards on the table. It's an excuse. It's an abuse. It's an excuse not to produce. Just label us disabled. Perhaps those that can read just cannot concede that our unmet need to read is causing this great nation to bleed. Don't watch us bleed. Please teach us all to read. We have a right to grieve, but we must learn how to read. Don't leave us now. Don't leave us now. Please teach us all to read. The stage is set for basic skills. Don't expect instant thrills. It's going to take drills and drills before we have those basic skills. The year 2000, that's our goal. And remember, none of us are too old to reach our goal. We must be bold. And if you agree, back your words with this deed. Roll up your sleeves and teach us all to read. I love you. Thank you.
Thank you, John. Could you get the... appropriately after that, we have the section on children. And Paula Talal will lead that off, co-director of the Center for Molecular and Behavioral Neuroscience at Rutgers, one of the founders of Scientific Learning Corporation, co-director of the Educational Outreach Center of the TDLC, and immensely helpful in and supportive in putting this whole thing together. So, Paula.
All right, so we're supposed to give our one main thought, and here's mine. It's spoken language, that's the foundation on which reading is built. And for a variety of biological, social, and cultural reasons, increasing numbers of children are entering school without sufficiently strong spoken language skills on which to build adequate reading and other literacy skills. Our hypothesis is that the most effective route to improving reading is to strengthen the basic perceptual and cognitive building blocks that build spoken language proficiency. Over 30 years of research has shown that individual differences in language development are predicted by a child's ability to discriminate brief, rapidly successive sounds, specifically in this teeny time window that we heard a lot about this morning, the tens of millisecond time range, that's essential for phoneme perception. Children with weak language skills in the early school years can't actually discriminate two simple tones when they're presented at rapid rates. They have no difficulty when they're presented at about a half a second. That's the half a second of silence between two tones. They can easily discriminate and sequence the order in which they heard those tones. But when we move into the range that's important for syllable perception, you see, the children with weak language skills absolutely fall apart. Same two sounds, the only variable that changes is how fast we present them. And we move into the range that's so important for phoneme perception. These children really are at a disadvantage. Now, for speech, this tens of millisecond time range can actually change the entire meaning of a word. These two waveforms are identical, except for an inserted 100 milliseconds of silence. And yet we hear two completely different words.
Say.
Without the silence, put in 100 milliseconds.
Say.
In order to be able to read and spell, we need to hear these small acoustic differences inside of words and learn that it's these sounds, the phonemes, that go with the letters. Individual differences in processing rate are present very early in life. You saw this morning from Gary Cottrell. This baby has learned that something interesting happens to her left when two rapidly presented tones are different. This paradigm can be used to establish an individual threshold for what we call rapid auditory processing. This rapid auditory processing threshold in this study established at about 7.5 months of age, 7.5 months of age, turns out to be the single best predictor of language development in children at 3 years and 4 years of age. This is the work of Dr. April Benesich. We see here that if you happen to be a baby who needs a considerable amount of time, in this hundreds of milliseconds, in order to hear the differences between these sounds, by the time you're 3 years old, you have very, very little language development. If you can process a little bit more quickly in this simple little task, your language development is better. And those babies who are really able to process at the level that's important for phonemes and syllables, they have excellent language development in children, in their life. So we are going to propose a literacy continuum that begins with weak perceptual skills. That's going to lead to weak phonological representations. That's going to lead to a weakness in oral or spoken language development. And only that is what's going to end up bringing to the classroom a child who is not going to be ready to learn to read, write, and spell. As we know, if that's not corrected, we're going to end up with children with learning and academic problems across a variety of ranges because reading is just essential. And that's going to lead to struggling students. So what would our goals for intervention? We've been talking all day about how do we translate what we've learned from all these years of neuroscience and cognitive science and psychological research into something that might be important. I would say that we begin by recognizing that we need to improve the fidelity of perception, particularly in the window of time that's important for sharpening phonological representations. And then enhancing spoken language abilities will lead us to the point that then we can really end up with strengthening reading, writing, and spelling, reducing learning and academic problems, and leading to successful students. We have designed computer exercises that capitalize on the neuroplasticity of the brain to reverse engineer the underlying neuronal bases of the perceptual and cognitive weaknesses in the brains of struggling learners. We have two proofs of concept. There's many, but I'm going to just show you two very, very quickly. We can use fMRI, brain imaging, and see that there are actual differences in the brains of good and poor readers in this particular task while they're viewing two letters and just determining if they rhyme. We see here that in the controls children, they activate the frontal and the temporal parietal region of the left hemisphere. The dyslexic children who can do this task actually have a very messy activation in the frontal and no activation in the temporal parietal. Our proof of concept is that after we introduce this perceptual cognitive intervention strategy that takes this bottom-up processing approach of improving the precision of perceptual and cognitive skills, we see that after training, the metabolic activity of the brains of dyslexic children much more closely resemble the typical normal readers. Second proof of concept is, did reading improve? In the original studies that were done, the approach was to improve the perceptual, cognitive, and language skills of children. No letters were used, and yet after only 6 weeks of training, we see and going from well below average in real word reading to entering into the average range in non-word reading and in passage comprehension. So schools are in the business of teaching children how to read. And my news flash, or my thought bomb for the day, is that if we're going to really make progress in that area, we need to understand the basic building blocks on which good reading depends from a neurocognitive perspective, and that is perceptual into language. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Paula. Next up is Adele Diamond from University of British Columbia, Professor of Developmental Cognitive Neuroscience, indeed one of the founders of the field.
Okay. I'm going to be talking about the cognitive control functions that depend on prefrontal cortex, the executive function. So I thought I would start by explaining what they are. There are really three core cognitive skills that make up the executive functions. One of them is inhibitory control. That's the ability to resist the strong inclination to do one thing and instead do what's most appropriate or needed. For example, it might be resisting the first impulse, perhaps to say a socially inappropriate remark, and instead give a more considered, polite response. Or staying on task despite boredom or the temptation to go out and play. Or controlling your attention despite distraction, selective or sustained attention. That's one of the three core executive functions. The next is working memory. Working memory means holding information in mind while mentally working with it or updating it. For example, it might be relating one idea to another, doing mental arithmetic, understanding a story, relating the beginning, middle, and end, remembering the order in which things need to be done, etc., etc. The third core executive function is cognitive flexibility, being able to flexibly switch perspectives or the focus of attention, flexibly adjusting to change demands or priorities, being able to think outside the box. These executive function skills are important for school readiness. Indeed, they're more strongly associated with school readiness than is IQ or entry-level reading and math. They're also critically important for school success. Working memory and inhibitory control, each independently, predict both math and reading competence throughout the school years. Indeed, discipline accounts for over twice as much variance in final grades as does IQ, even in college. Many children begin school lacking these needed executive function skills. Kindergarten children at risk because of economic disadvantage are disproportionately behind in these skills, behind compared to other cognitive skills, and disproportionately behind relative to children from more advantaged families. Thus, I predict that improving young children's executive function skills will improve their long-term acquisition of academic skills, their school success and retention, and can reduce the disparity in achievement between rich and poor. How can we help young children develop these critical executive function skills? Well, one way is a program called Tools of the Mind that was developed by two educational psychologists, Ilana Batrova and Deborah Leong, based on the theories of Vygotsky and Loria. I had nothing to do with Tools of the Mind. I still don't have anything to do with Tools of the Mind. I can't claim any credit for it. I just researched the effects of it. Deb and Ilana tried executive function activities as a module added onto a curriculum. What they found was that children improved on what they practiced in the module, but it didn't generalize to other contexts or other executive function skills. Tools of the Mind is therefore grounded in the idea that social, emotional, and cognitive self-regulation is learned best by embedding training in that in all aspects of what children do throughout the school day. Now, Vygotsky emphasized the critical importance of social pretend play for the development of self-regulation and executive functions. And if you think about it, during social pretend play, children have to hold in mind their own role and those of others, working memory. You have to inhibit acting out of character. You have to exercise inhibitory control. And your friends may take the plot in ways you had never imagined. And on the fly, you have to cognitively adjust to that. So all three of the core executive functions thus get exercised in social pretend play. Well, we were very lucky in doing the study because we were able to get a school district that was just implementing full-day preschool. So they had tools of the mind, and they had a program that the district had worked on for 3 years to develop. Both programs were newly instituted at the same time, had all the same materials, even the same furniture. The teachers were given the same preparation. The teachers were randomly assigned on matched and matched on how much years of education they had and how many years of teaching they had, and the children were randomly assigned. The conditions differed only in that the tools condition included executive function promoting activities interwoven in all school activities throughout the day. The children came from the same neighborhood and, as I said, were randomly assigned. They were very well matched on almost all variables. For our two executive function outcome measures, we specifically chose activities completely different from anything the children had ever done before. To see a difference by condition, the children would have to transfer their training in executive function to utterly new situations. One of our outcome measures was this test here. When you see a heart, you're supposed to press on the same side. When you see a flower, you're supposed to press on the opposite side. So you have to hold two arbitrary rules in mind. When you see a flower, you have to inhibit the tendency to press on the same side. And then the mixed condition, you have to flexibly switch between the two rules. Well, what we found is if you look just at the block of flower trials, where you always have to inhibit which side you have to look on, you see a linear relationship between percent correct and how many years of tools you had. Now, this relationship is statistically significant, but it's small, it's minor. You need statistics to see the difference. If you look at the mixed condition, though, most of the children in tools, more than 70%, most of the children not in tools, more than 70% of them couldn't get to first base. They couldn't even demonstrate during training that they were capable of doing this at all. Whereas almost twice as many of the children in tools, over 50%, could show that during training. The other outcome measure is called the flanker task. Here you have to attend to the direction that the center stimulus is pointing and ignore the flankers on the side. So you have to press to the left side. After a block of those trials, we give a reverse flanker. Now you have to attend to the flanking stimuli and ignore the center stimulus. Okay? The flanker task has been used in many cognitive science experiments. It's always found to exist, but it's always found to be very small. And it's extremely sensitive to stimulus parameters. So if the stimuli are too big or too far apart, the effect goes away. And you can see that in our own data. If you introduce the reverse flanker, however, and if in adults they have to switch between the reverse flanker and the regular flanker, now you see the flanker effect is 6 to 10 times larger, it's much more robust, and it's not sensitive to stimulus parameters. Well, what did we find with the Tools of the Mind study? We found, again, that if you look just at the flanker condition, the children in tools did statistically significantly better than the children in the district curriculum, but it's not a big effect. You need statistics to see it. It's small. But if you look at the reverse flanker, the children in the district curriculum are performing a chance. The children in tools are performing 30, 40% better in terms of percent correct. That's a big difference. That's an important difference. Whether children were in tools or not accounted for more variance in executive function than did age or gender. Our finding of superior performance on these objective measures also fits with independent findings that on questionnaire measures, parents and teachers rate children in tools to be higher on executive functions. Academic outcome measures on these children were obtained completely independently of us. When we put the data together, we found that the more demanding of executive function a particular condition of our tests was, the more highly that condition correlated with academic performance. So, for example, the congruent condition, which was the heart condition, where you just press whenever side the stimulus appears, you're just doing what comes naturally. It doesn't require executive function. Performance on that didn't correlate with any of the academic outcome measures. The flower condition requires some executive function. It correlated with some of the outcome measures. The mixed condition requires the most executive function. It shows the highest correlations with academic measures and the most correlations with academic measures. Superior academic performance in children who've been through tools has been replicated in other Tools of the Mind programs with other children and teachers in other schools and states and with different comparison conditions. The take-home message is that executive function skills can be improved even in preschoolers. Now you say, well, Dr. Gee got up and told us that these executive function abilities depend on prefrontal cortex, and prefrontal cortex isn't fully matured until 25 years old. How dare you tell me that in preschoolers you can do something that requires this thing which isn't fully mature till 15, 20 years later? Well, think about it. Your legs at 2 years of age are not their full adult height. Yet at 2 years, you can walk and you can even run. Prefrontal cortex can subserve important executive function abilities even when it's not fully mature. My dissertation showed that it can be improved even in infancy. Prefrontal cortex isn't fully mature till your mid-20s, but it's still subserving important abilities very early in life. And this can be done in regular classrooms with regular teachers without special equipment. Though often thought frivolous, play may be essential. Tool uses dramatic play to help improve executive functions, and it produces better outcomes on academic tests than programs that spend more time on academic instruction. Consider this. Poor executive function leads to problems paying attention in class, completing assignments, and inhibiting impulsive behaviors. School is less fun because the teacher's always getting annoyed at you, and because compliance with what school demands is very hard. Teachers come to expect poor self-regulation and poor work, and the children come to see themselves as poor students. Hence, children who begin school with poor executive function would be expected to become increasingly resistant to school and schoolwork, put less effort and self-investment in school, and it's no surprise that they drop out at higher rates. On the other hand, children who have better executive function are likely to be praised for their good behavior, enjoy school more, and want to spend more time on their lessons. Their teachers enjoy them, and a self-reinforcing positive feedback loop is created. I hypothesize, therefore, that the benefit from early executive function training might increase over time, and that helping at-risk children improve their executive function skills early might be critical to closing the achievement gap and reducing societal inequalities. I also predict that children who go through a preschool program that directly teaches and supports executive functions will be less likely to be diagnosed with disorders of executive function, like ADHD. Not all of them, but some children. Because some children get diagnosed with ADHD just because they never learned how to regulate themselves. And I'd just like to close with a little plug. This conference I'm going to plug is not for my scientist research colleagues. It's for the people on the front lines. It's for the educators, the parents, the school administrators, the family physicians, to tell people who are on the front lines working with children about some of the cutting-edge research in neuroscience and education in a way that's understandable and applicable. And we have evidence to support that we do what we say, because it's a biannual meeting. We already had the first meeting, and people found that we achieved our goal. The educators loved it. And people talked about how for years I've seen people try to bring educators together with health specialists or either with researchers, and I've never seen any effort work as well as what you put together in Vancouver. It's an effort where the teachers aren't just the listeners, they're also the educators, and there's a dialogue. And I'd like to encourage you to think about coming in to tell your colleagues. Thank you very much.
Next is Javier Mavean, who is the director of the Machine Perception Laboratory at UC San Diego and the godfather of Ruby the Robot.
So I'm the guy that puts together robots in his garage and gets in trouble with the Homeowners Association. And in my free time, I'm also a scientist. I direct and founded the Machine Perception Laboratory, where our goal is actually to develop computer vision systems and machine perception primitives that would enable machines to do social interaction with people. And this includes things like smile detection, expression recognition, and then we also put together these systems, aim to put together these systems into robots and animated agents that have to interact with people in real time. So I'm bringing here as an approach that so far we haven't heard of in this conference. We heard the behavioral science approach. We've heard the neuroscience approach. What I bring here is a computational approach, where the goal is really to try and understand what the brain is doing by putting together systems that have to operate with their own sensors and their own actuators in real life, and then become marveled by the difficult problems that the brain is solving, and to get ideas also from neuroscientists on how is it that the brain solves these problems. And as I said, our focus is on real-time social interaction. I apologize for that. So I'm going to talk about the Ruby project. And this is a project actually partially funded by by Sony Corporation and the UC Discovery program. And the goal was really to explore the potential value of social robot technology in early childhood education. So I want to tell you something about the philosophy of the project. We felt it was very important to understand the technological and scientific problems that we needed to solve in order to develop this technology. And we felt in order to do this, it's critical that we embed ourselves into a classroom environment. So we took this embedded and iterative design. We wanted to have the children and the parents and the teacher to influence our technology as early as possible in the development process. Right, so the ongoing results of this project have been recently published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Science. What I want to tell you about now is a little bit of the personal lessons that we learn out of trying to embed research into an educational environment. The first one was the critical importance of in situ development and evaluation. So we are experts on computer vision. We had developed what in all papers appeared to be the best expression recognition system in the world. It was performing really well in all the data sets. We put it in this robot, we took it to this early childhood education center at UCSD, and it didn't work. It was almost a chance. So this was very important to us. We were shocked. And it told us of the importance of actually developing systems in the unconstrained conditions where they are supposed to operate. This actually ended up being very advantageous to us. We learned our system wasn't working. In 1 year, we figured out what it took to have a system that could work in natural conditions. And we believe this very same technology that we put together may revolutionize the study of human behavior. By the way, when you buy the latest Sony camera with smile detection, the system that is put by Sony there came out of the Ruby project. The importance of embedding science and engineering. So just to tell you that many of the phenomena that we observed occurred because we were there with the teachers on a daily basis for months at a time. And if we had done laboratory studies only, we would have missed the big picture. Embedding ourselves helped gather science and gave us a technological edge. An example of this is the smile detection system that ended up in Sony cameras. Another important thing is when we try to force a scripted design, kind of like, okay, let's control the situation in a more so-called scientific way, we broke the magic that was happening, and in a way we kind of were breaking the phenomena that we were really trying to study. All right, so I had to throw my bomb. The bomb is that we really need to rethink about current scientific concepts and methods. Many of the concepts I was trained on as a cognitive scientist, I found them to be not very useful when we face the problem of a system that had to survive and interact with children in real life. Yet many new concepts and phenomena emerged that we had not anticipated. For example, this idea of the magic that occurred, the intense feelings that occur between the robots and the children when we hit the timing right, and how that disappeared when we didn't hit it right. And I have this friend of mine where I was telling her, you know, all my training, it seemed like it was not useful to develop this robot. And she told me, well, you know, nobody said we have a mind, but we sort of have a brain, and the brain may not necessarily want to work like, you know, we're told the mind works. We also observe what I think is a very dangerous cycle, which is this sense of a science that has grown outside of the classroom being imposed and indoctrinated into the teachers. And I particularly found it I was very concerned when rules were given to teaching that were supposed to be scientific and that work against their own common sense, their own intuitions, and their daily experience. So challenges, I think it's very important to think about the development of a science of learning and education whose questions and practices are grounded from the very beginning in educational practice. I see this so-called translational model as being too paternalistic. I think other people have talked about this already here. We need teachers to help us develop the science and the engineering from the ground up. It's not really about us translating, it's about them giving us ideas. I think it's important to question the established scientific practices and methods. We found, for example, that many of the theories that were out there were not particularly useful for the problem that we had to solve, which was interacting with other human beings. More control did not always lead to better science. In fact, it destroyed the phenomena that we're trying to study. And in this, you know, I do believe that we are really at the verge of a revolution in that massive amount of data may be actually be collected from many classrooms, and data mining as new machine learning techniques could be used that are an alternative to standard laboratory methods. Also, I think it's important to help scientists recognize the values and the opportunities that arise when they become part of an educational community. I'm gonna.
Thanks very much, Javier. Next is Hal Pashler, who is a professor of psychology at UC San Diego. We mentioned in the opening pages of the brochure that you may have heard about the Mozart effect, but not about the spacing effect. Perhaps you will hear about the spacing effect.
I'm going to be talking about the timing of learning events and how that affects forgetting. The most efforts to use cognitive science research to benefit education have really focused on, I mean, some of it's focused on skills, which has been the topic of a lot of discussion in this panel so far, but a great deal of it is also focused on insight and trying to understand the events that lead somebody from a state of puzzlement to a state of mastery and understanding. But I think we all know from experience that the sad fact is that with the further passage of time, it's very possible to regress to the initial state of comprehension and bafflement. And this is something experimental psychologists have been studying for a little bit over 100 years, and in a sort of quantitative way, if you just look at people's ability to recall information, it's relatively easy to do experiments in which you can see the very magnitude at which information is lost. So here's a case where people were recalling about 90% of some information at a one-day retention interval, and if you went out 6 weeks, they were down to remembering about a third of it. There's a significant, not a huge, literature looking at long-term follow-ups of information people learn in schools. And the results certainly confirm, they look very much like the laboratory studies. There's been quite a few long-term follow-ups on college education suggesting that within a year, a great deal of the information that people have explicitly accessible is gone. That might or might not worry you, but certainly doctors forgetting signs and symptoms of illnesses is demonstrably huge effect over a 12-month period. There have been studies that show, looking at workplace training, most people in the business world at one time or another were trained to use Microsoft Excel to the level where they could put a formula in the formula box and use that. But when asked to do it right now, about 20% of them are able to do it. It's interesting, when I talk to teachers, I think this is something that everybody's very well aware of. People see the effects of it, particularly after summer vacations. The thing that I find a little puzzling is when you look in the educational literature, when I say the education field, I mean the education journals and textbooks, you don't see a lot of discussion of forgetting, even though I think it's something that's the bane of the work of daily educators. There is, however, one person who's been long mindful of the role of forgetting. If you recall from Saturday Night Live, Father Guido Sarducci, forgetting was the very premise of his entire college. He said people who have been to college can tell you what they learned in just 5 minutes. So at my college, students learn the same stuff all in 5 minutes. Our research, you might think, well, it's like death and taxes. What are you going to do about it? It turns out, though, that from the field of learning and memory psychology, there have been some work that begins to point to procedures that really very practical, concrete procedures that could be done in the learning environment to reduce the rate of forgetting, which have some potential. And the focus in my lab has been to try to develop and refine these and see how their effects are. In fact, the only thing I have time to talk about in this brief time is one of these, and that's looking at the effects of temporal spacing of learning. So this isn't a complicated situation. Let's just imagine that we've got time going from left to right here, and you're going to study some information once, and then you're going to study the same information again. And the time between the first study and the second study we'll refer to as the study gap. Then after some additional delay, you're going to get some final test, and we'll look at how well you can remember the information. There's been a great deal of studies in which the test delay is fixed at, you know, a day or something like that, and then various different study gaps are used. And going back to the work of Ebbinghaus a century ago, it's been shown that this can make a big difference. There's actually a huge, if you've majored in psychology, you know there's a huge literature on spacing effects. And actually, here it is. This is about 400 and some papers. A postdoc of mine did a meta-analysis of the literature and found 400 papers. So you might think, well, with all of that research, why do we not know everything we'd need to know about a phenomenon like that for practical purposes? Well, the answer is, well, if you're going to think about practical purposes, we're interested in teaching people so they remember things over a considerable period. And it would seem like a modest request to have that period be at least 24 hours. So what does the literature look like before we got to this topic with retention intervals of at least 1 day? This is the literature. It's actually about 12 papers. So what do those 12 papers tell us? Well, this is basically the pre-existing literature in this area. Study gap is on the x-axis, and what's on the y-axis here is the total amount that people can remember at that final test. So what you see is when you add 1 day of spacing, performance gets better. What's remembered on the final gap gets better. This isn't obvious if you think about it, because you've added 1 day between the initial study and the final test. In a sense, you've added more opportunity to forget from that initial study, but the results are good. After additional delays, it looks like it goes down. The only problem, however, is that the test delays in all these experiments were never longer than 7 days. So you're only looking at what's the best way to teach people if you want them to remember something in a week. So what we've done is scale this up to big intervals. And let me show you some of the results that we've been getting. We've done some laboratory experiments with 6-month test delays. So this is something where you're going to study something once. There'll be a certain gap of time, and that's what's on the x-axis here. Then you study it a second time, and then 6 months pass, and you get a final test, okay? And you see that what happens is there's a big effect of the study gap, and the optimal study gap is not 1 day, it's actually 28 days. So 1 month is producing the best memory if you have to hang on to it for an additional 6 months. Here's a 10-day case, which is much more like the earlier literature, and here you see 1 day is actually better than either 0 days or anything more than that. So what's going on here? Well, you can see that with the long 6-month retention interval, it looks like you want a long delay. And with the 10-day, you want a short delay. One point to notice is here is we are equating the total amount of time people spend studying. So this is the result of a fixed amount of time devoted to studying this material. And yet there are, in the long 6-month delay, there are 2- or 3-fold increases in the amount that are remembered. So putting that 1 month delay in between the two study sessions gives you a return of a factor of 3 in terms of what you remember 6 months later. I think the most illuminating way to look at the data is instead of looking at the study gap, look at the study gap as a fraction of the test delay. And now you see that the three studies line up pretty much at the same peak. The peaks are at about 10 to 20%. So what does this mean? It means if you want to remember for some period of time, you had better have your two study sessions spaced by about 10 to 20% of the length of time that you want to remember it. You want to remember it for a week, 1 day would be a nice choice. You want to remember it for a year, a couple months would be a good choice. You want to remember it for 10 years, well, we haven't done the experiment to 10 years, but extrapolating forward, it looks like you're going to want a long time. You're going to want months into the range of years. We've just finished a, We just finished a much bigger study with almost 2,000 subjects in which we've looked at a wide range of delays and really plotted this out as a surface here, which I don't have time to walk you through, but the results reinforce what I was showing you before. About a 10 to 20% ratio looks good. So let me wrap this up with some practical implications. What is this telling us? It says that the optimal use of study time to reduce forgetting depends, unfortunately, on how long you want to remember stuff. So as a teacher, you got to ask, well, how long do you want them to remember stuff? And I guess you want them to remember it a long time, probably years. If that's the case, you want to have a substantial gap between the first time they experience a concept and the second or last time, at least, that they experience a concept. You want spacing that's a good fraction of that desired retention interval. If you can achieve that, it will mean that the total returns much later on what you've taught them will be many times what they would have been if you had not been able to do that. So for long-term retention, you really want at least two study sessions separated by months or even a few years. And I think it's obvious that the present-day curriculum rarely provides that. Interestingly, I think it sort of sporadically and incidentally provides it. So bar review, lawyers tell me they don't forget stuff from their law school curriculum. They had a bar exam that reviewed the whole thing 3 years later. I think the British educational system has exams at the end and may incidentally do that. The spiral curriculum may, despite its other demerits, may do that to some degree for science education. But I think a tremendous amount of what people learn in school, particularly in areas like biology, social studies, they get very little review, and they get an intensive review right within a short period. It's a real prescription for dramatic forgetting. So when we look at these data that embarrass the education field by showing that 30% of students can't find the Pacific Ocean on a map, that's not because they were never taught. There was a point in time when they could find the Pacific Ocean on a map. My favorite, actually, is a recent British study showed that more people in the UK, high school graduates, believed that Sherlock Holmes was a real person than that Winston Churchill was a real person. It's disturbing, isn't it? But again, I think people read that and they go, my God, what are they teaching in the schools? Well, I'm sure there was a point where they knew about Winston Churchill. I don't know about Sherlock Holmes. But the point is, if you want long-term retention for material that won't automatically get reviewed within the curriculum, then you really need to be thinking of how to arrange reviews at a very substantial delay if you want long-term retention. And doing so can multiply the effects of your instruction many times. And then finally, you see these functions rise and then fall, but the fall is always much shallower. So the cost of having too long an interval is much less than the gain, is much less than the cost of having it be too short. So I think the education system currently, I think where there isn't automatic re-review of material, there is dramatic forgetting that could be avoided by appropriately providing for spaced instruction. Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much, Hal. Next up is Mary Helen Imordino-Yang. There's actually two people here today representing the wonderful journal Mind, Brain, and Education, which our final speaker, Kurt Fisher, founded, in fact. Mary Helen's the North American editor. She's also, obviously, working locally at USC, as you can see from the program, and has involvements at the Brain and Creativity Institute, which is, I believe, Antonio Damasio and Hannah Damasio.
That's right, yeah.
And the Rossier School of Education. So, when you're ready.
Okay, great, thanks. So, my talk is going to be complementary to the ones that have come already in several ways, which I don't have time in my little short allotment to go into, but I hope will become clear to you as I go on. I'm talking about the emotion, the social interaction that undergirds the learning processes that we're all talking about. So when we're talking about the cognitive processes that go into reading and math and other kinds of traditional cognitive skills that kids are tested on and that they're expected to know about in school, several times throughout the day, the implicit notion has come up that these skills are learned in social interactions and that the emotions that go on in those social interactions are critical to the ways that people construct the cognitive knowledge, that these two things go together. So I'm going to start with a warning. This talk is very dark and scary, okay? I'm talking about the stuff we don't like to talk about, that policymakers tend to overlook. When we have schools that aren't doing well, or even schools that are, we focus on the cognitive stuff. We want them to remediate the skills. So I want my kids to drill and practice. I want them to know how to do these basic things. And of course, kids do need to know how to do those basic things. But I'm going to take us in a kind of a new direction. Let's understand these learning processes from a different perspective, and it's kind of a scary one. It's the one that talks about things like the self and consciousness and how students' sense of self-awareness forms a platform for them to interact in social settings such as schools and how learning might happen in those settings. Okay. So the basic premise is that feelings about other people, okay, the kinds of feelings that we have in social interactions, are experienced on the substrate of the self. That's been known for some time. It's been posited first in psychology. And now we're starting to understand what that actually means from a neuroscientific point of view. And interestingly, as we learn more about the neurological substrates of the self, we're beginning to find new dimensions of the self or new divisions between the sort of aspects of the self that I think might have educational implications for the way that we design school environments, especially urban ones. These are, I must tell you, very new data. They're under review right now, and the implications are even newer, so I would love your thoughts about them by the end. So, one important example of an emotion, of a social emotion that guides people's behavior and learning is admiration. When we are really taken with, inspired by another person, it makes us want to do better. It makes us want to be better, more learned, more effective people, to live a good life, to be ethical and moral, and to have sort of a meaningful life. Right? So we set out to try to understand what the neural basis of an emotion like admiration might be. And basically, the things that I want to point out to you are that an emotion like admiration involves some very interesting neural systems. How do I make this work? Ah, there we go. This is a picture of the brain with the data imposed on it. This is data from someone, from a group of subjects who are feeling, who subjectively report to us that they're feeling incredibly overwhelmed with inspiration and awe about another person, about the virtuosity of another person. And the way that the experiment went is first people came to the lab, they sit with me for about 2 hours. We go through a series of stories about real people. They're all true stories. Some of the stories are incredibly inspiring, and they're inspiring in different ways. Some of the stories are incredibly inspiring in terms of their virtuosity. And when people interact around these stories, and I ask them, how does this story make you feel? They say things like, well, the person's incredibly inspiring. She's amazing. I can't believe she was able to do that, the dedication that she has. And it makes me feel like I want to be a better person, right? I want to live a meaningful life. I want to do good with my life. I don't want to squander it away. When people are subjectively in these states in the scanner, this is the kind of activation patterns that we get. And I want to point out to you a few things. First, what you notice is that you saw earlier in the day, somebody put up kind of a textbook view, they said, of the brain and said, there's no obligation on the part of the brain to conform to our psychological theories, right? That's exactly where I'm going with this. In fact, it's very interesting the way the brain kind of hijacks these systems for different kinds of aims. What I want to point out to you first is these structures over here. These are called the insula, in particular the anterior insula. This is a head sliced through this way, and this is the front, and this is the back. These are these huge territories of folded tissue in there, and what they do, actually, is represent the state of the gut. They feel the gut and the viscera for you, right? If you have a stomach ache, this is where you feel it. And it turns out, when you're really inspired by someone else, this is also where you feel it. This is something that recruits the very essence of the feeling of your own gut and viscera. That gut sense that you have is actually guiding your behavior and your decision making in these states. Another thing I want to point out to you is this area right over in here. This, in the map from the textbook before, was the mesencephalon. This is the part of the brain that is crammed with little nuclei that do things like keep you alive, right? If you have a stroke in there, you die very rapidly. It does things like control your heart rate and your blood pressure and keep you breathing, you know, very basic stuff. Lo and behold, when you're inspired, the part of you that actually controls in a very non-conscious, very low-level, automatic brainstem kind of way that controls your heart rate, your blood pressure, is actually becoming differently activated. It's getting engaged in the process of you feeling emotional about people. So the lesson here is that the body is a fundamental substrate on which we play out even complex things like emotions about other people. And to think that we're sort of heads walking around in social interactions, and when you kind of get the emotion out of the way, get the body fed and taken care of, and then you can learn. That's just really fundamentally not how we operate as biological systems. And I was very happy to see that there have been several talks already today that have alluded to this fact and that have brought up things like the role of exercise in learning and things like that. Okay. I want to point out one other thing, and that is I'm taking you, this is a brain, this is the eyes, this is the back and the front, right in the middle, in an area in here that is very, this is a blown up view, it's an area called the precuneus and the postromedial cortices, which is very important in self-awareness and self-consciousness. Okay? This is a part of the brain, especially the inferior part here, that that degrades when you have late stage Alzheimer's disease. For instance, when you really start to lose your sense of self, your core self, when you don't know who you are anymore. This is an area that's suppressed during anesthesia. It's an area where activity there can predict whether vegetative states will waken from their states and become conscious again or not. Okay, this is an area that's incredibly central for states of consciousness. Now, do not go away and go home and say, oh, Mary Helen pointed out where our sense of self is in the brain. That's not what this is. Okay, but what it is a sort of a convergence zone, a high-level association area that when you bring all of this information together about your memories and your life and who you are and the current context, when all of that information comes together to produce holistic representations of what's going on, what we might subjectively experience that as is a heightened sense of self-awareness, of myself as a person. Right? And what you see here is actually a map of two different conditions contrasted. What you have is much more activation down here for people who are feeling very inspired about the virtuosity of another person, the kind of feeling that makes you say, I want to be a better person. Okay? This is more activation in a slightly different region for people who are very admiring of the other person's skill, saying, that basketball player is amazing. Watch him make his free throw line dunk. Okay? Now, this is what I ask you. There are two aspects of the sense of self in these social relationships that are playing off one another. And I'll point out one other thing. This area, it looks like, to be able to recruit this area, involves a suppression of outward-directed activity. Okay, this area is characteristically more active when you're, quote, doing nothing. Okay, what you're really doing is sort of turning inward to your own sense of self, kind of experiencing who you are and daydreaming, if you like. And here's what I'll put to you. If this area is critically activated for the feelings of social emotion that inspire you to be a better person, a more engaged person, not just a better basketball player who's skillful, but somebody who wants to live a meaningful life, the kind of emotion that really moves kids to get over, you know, their dyslexia or to stay in school despite all odds, what they might need are conditions in schools and home life where they have the opportunity to shut down for a little while and move between, right? I'm not saying that you don't want this some of the time, but to shut down the outwardly focused network, the network that helps you have executive function outwardly, that helps you focus on tasks, that helps you do drill and practice in school, that keeps your head out of the clouds and makes you looking around on your way home from school that nobody's following you. That kind of network might need to get shut, sort of transferred so that you've got a balance so the kid has an opportunity to turn inward and daydream and pull up this self network, which, by the way, it's this network that is much more heavily connected to the viscera and the gut. They need to turn inward to their own gut feelings, shut down that outwardly directed sense of attention for a little bit in order to have these inspirational states. And oftentimes our educational designs and pedagogies and environments don't encourage that kind of skill, that skill of turning inward, which might be critical to really inspire kids in school. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. And as I intimated before, next up is Kurt Fischer, who is Director of Mind, Brain, and Education and Bigelow Professor at Harvard. And he founded the International MBE Society and, as I said, the award-winning journal Mind, Brain, and Education. Welcome, Kurt. Yep.
Thank you. I'm going to now not talk about Mind, Brain, and Education. That's for the later session. I'm instead going to talk about the work we've been doing to figure out what a good way, figure a good way of measuring cognitive development and learning and emotional development. And the key criterion, what I'm going to talk about for defining this measurement scale is discontinuities in growth. We're going to talk a little bit about cognitive development, a little bit about brain development, a little bit about learning, since there's only 5 minutes. Okay, so in the cognitive example, I'm going to talk about a study we did of arithmetic operations, understanding arithmetic operations, where we found evidence for a series of discontinuities. Is this not loud enough? Oh, it fell out. I think I have a special talent for making them fall out. Not sure what that comes from. Okay, so in this study, we looked at we asked students to explain how addition and subtraction relate to each other, how addition and multiplication relate to each other, and so forth, as shown in this slide. We looked at students between 9 and 20 years of age. We first looked at how they answered these questions spontaneously without any support or help. As you can see, they did rather poorly. They had trouble explaining how division relates to multiplication or even how addition relates to multiplication. And only when they got out into the late teens and early 20s did they even come up to 30% correct on these kinds of problems. But when we showed them good answers, prototypic good answers, and we gave them a couple weeks to work on it, and we brought them back and tested them again, then we found a huge, rapid jump. This was our first explicit test of the idea that we could find spurts at in this capacity we were hypothesizing to emerge at about 15 or 16 years. As you can imagine, we were quite happy when this graph came out. We actually didn't expect it to be that dramatic. But there's a huge spurt at between 15 and 16 years in this sample for this optimal performance with prototypic support and practice. There's a whole lot of evidence for spurts like this. In fact, when you look at the what's this kind of standard or prototypic graph for growth, it's an S-shaped graph, not a straight line graph. An S-shape means that there's a point of rapid growth. So in general, there's a whole lot of evidence for spurts in skill at certain age intervals, which we've used to create this scale for assessing development and learning. Now, for brain development, we looked at EEG data that other people had collected. This particular study I'm going to talk about is a classic one by Matusik and Peterson in Sweden. Looking at the energy in the EEG. What they found was a series of jumps and plateaus during the adolescent years, actually during earlier years as well. At about 11 years of age, there's a jump. At about 15 years, around the same time as the math spurt, there's a jump. At around 19 or 20 years, there's a jump. There's a series of spurts in brain activity, in the energy and brain activity. and they correspond to the energy, to the spurts in cognitive performance as well. Now, our model is that this is a network that's growing. There's a whole bunch of other evidence about this that fits the idea that there's a network that gets revised or retuned for producing a new cognitive level. This is just a little bit about the network model. So we also have used the same ruler now to look at learning in classrooms in a bunch of situations, including in some of our classes at Harvard. We've found that the scale works quite well for tracking learning in classroom situations. So we've used it for pre-K to 12, we've used it for universities, we've used it for adult education, in particular with a bunch of research with the National Leadership College in DC. This is a kind of model for one of the things we find. You'll see over here, not sure how to get the pointer to work. This is the same scale I was just talking to you about, the complexity scale. And what happens when people are trying to master a new skill, in general, according to our research, is that they initially need to go down to a low level, acting in many ways like a child, build up skills for the new task that they're taking on. They then build up those skills, but they have trouble sustaining it. It collapses, then they build it up again, it collapses again, then they build it up again. So we see evidence for building up the skills repeatedly over time. If I can get to a real graph, this is an idealized graph. This is one particular student in one of our classes learning to do statistical analysis with a computer in a graduate class. You see this kind of scalloping process where they build up a skill, sustain it for a little while, it falls apart, then they build it up again, then it falls apart. So over time, to build up a general skill, something that they can use across situations, they need to build it and rebuild it and rebuild it. We've been able to track this process in several classroom situations and other learning situations. Broadly speaking then, we have a tool for measuring cognitive development, emotional development, and learning, which also seems to be connected to changes that go on in brain development. A lot more research needs to be done to pin that down. This tool turns out to be helpful for measuring how learning occurs in diverse domains, in classroom settings and other kinds of educational settings. So with this tool, we now can use the same scale for measuring learning of arithmetic, learning of critical thinking, we've done research on that, learning of energy concepts in middle school science, this gives us a kind of power in looking at education across domains that we haven't had available in the past. Thank you.
So if you could just take it, you already got your spot set out there, and if the other panelists could join you. Where are the teachers again? Does that make sense to you all? I mean, would somebody like to comment on that from the sharp end? What it's being like, whether that is stuff you could implement? Is that stuff you could use? Is that useful?
The whole panel or just the last
one? No, I'm the whole panel, actually, pretty much, actually. There was lots of tools in there. There was lots of, I assume, Hal, that to some extent, does your work overlap to some extent with Kurt's? It's...
Hello.
It might do.
Hello. Hello.
Would you like to speak?
Speaking as a teacher, I thought you asked us, right? You asked us.
Teacher... Are you a teacher?
Yes.
Oh, well, you can speak as a teacher then.
Okay. Well, thank you. What it does is it gives me the ability not to get ticked off when they forget stuff. You know, I mean, if they can't help forgetting, then I just kind of have to do with good cheer, reteach things, because it's going to take them a while to learn it, especially when they're 15 and 16.
But, I mean, in practical terms, I mean...
Yes.
I mean, take your spacing effect stuff, as you said. I mean, that's kind of tricky, isn't it? It also sounds a little bit counter...
I think that the practical suggestion is sort of identify key material that doesn't automatically get reviewed. So a lot of things, you know, you learn to add, it will get reviewed in the course of all the other math you'll do. But when you have content, important content that you don't want to be forgotten, then you, not only do you want to do some reviewing, which you might do anyway, but you want to put that as substantially later. And expect that you will be frustrated that they appear to have forgotten, but that's still fine. It's still much better to do it later than it is to do it earlier.
But isn't that sort of a little bit counterintuitive? I mean, don't people still seem to think that there should be just rote
repetition
and repetition?
Intuitive. Presumably people already do everything that's intuitive. To me, the interest is in finding things that are not intuitive, yeah.
Yes.
I don't have a question. Well, I do, but it would take a long time to talk about this. Everybody on this panel... What you have to say has implications for instruction, and it has implications also for constructing curriculum, and it has implications for how we construct how we teach kids, just in terms of a day, a week, a year, how we run kids through a system. Starting, if you want to talk about kindergarten, I mean, preschool, definitely. But kindergarten, and then does everybody run through kindergarten and 12th at the same pace and in the same time period? The whole notion of a 3-month or 2-month summer vacation, we really need to question that. But everything that you've said, and I'm just saying this in a very general way, has implications for all of those things. And the first two speakers, I'm an English teacher, and I was a professional development specialist and a reading teacher. The executive functions, absolutely. And certainly the first speaker, what you were talking about, I mean, the speaking. We have kids who do not know how to speak in full sentences. And that's one thing that every teacher and every adult can help a kid do, is to speak in full sentences. Just as a little gem there.
There was somebody up here.
I speak as a parent, and I think it was Mary... Helen and Mardino Yang. Just a reminder that so often when our children need remedial instruction, they're pulled out of the class they love and do well at, and how they need that downtime. So I appreciated hearing that, and also the whole issue of the most effective time to be teaching our children is basically on the scaffolded scale that we saw, and I think in the last presentation. So thank you.
Yeah, here.
I'm Gloria Duff. I'm from Nevada, and I'm the deputy there. And my reaction to each of the discrete presentations was, wow, that really does have implications. But you're each looking at such a different function that I'm sitting at a system level saying, what are the implications for running a school system? What are the implications for every school, for every level of school, and blending it into a system that's connected and makes sense for improving the achievement? So it, for me, it's the beginning of disparate pieces of information that I would like blended together in a systemic way to say, so wow, how do I design the optimal system? What does it look like? What are the parameters?
Does anybody have any comments on that, on the panel?
Well, I think people touched on it this morning when they talked about process versus content. Because even if you space things out, people are going to forget a lot of the facts that you taught them. But if they learn how to learn and they enjoy learning, then they're going to be able to relearn that material and learn other material. So the content is less important than the skills very often. And the skills that are really critical in the beginning are the skills that make the foundation for doing everything else. Now, one of the critical skills Paula Talal talked about, because if you don't have that fine auditory processing ability, then you're going to miss out on all those language skills and everything else that builds on that if you don't get that early. But also the executive function skills are really critical early, in part because if you're lacking them, you keep having negative experiences in school, which just turn you off to the whole process. Whereas if you can get those in early, then school is a pleasure, and the teacher thinks, what a pleasure you are. And you think, gee, I'm getting strokes here. I like this, and I can do it. So I would say to focus early on the building block things.
Is it? Can I just ask a question there? It brings Mary Helen in as well. Is it helpful to people out here if you can show them a scan, for example, and say, look, you've got, instead of saying you've got impulse control, and you can, does it help to actually be able to talk at the level of serotonin levels? Does it help to talk about those sorts of things, to actually know about the neurochemistry, or is it just a total?
The McCabe study that just came out recently, showing that if you just add a brain image to a research report, that people believe the results.
I can speak to that. Yeah, I think that I want to just follow up on, first of all, thank you so much for that that question or comment, and follow up on what Adele said. And that is that the building blocks on which learning depends is really, I think, what understanding them better and also understanding how they relate to each other inside the brain is really the transformational change that could occur from really marrying the science with education right now, because education has so been focused on content and meeting content-based standards. And what we're saying here is really transformational, and that is that the research itself is very hopeful, first of all, that the brain is highly plastic, and particularly it's plastic for those central processing and cognitive skills. Attention. I mean, what happens if you can just build the child's focused attentional capacity? What effect will that have on every aspect of what we're trying to teach them? What happens if we can just build the child's memory? We can call this executive function. We could call it basic cognitive skills. We can show how these skills relate back to the perceptual level that I'm talking about. How do you pay attention to something your brain couldn't pick up as even being different, as Urs Ribery said this morning? If your brain didn't register a second event, you can't pay attention to it. So these are not separate modules or skills. They're all interrelated, and I hope that maybe what we'll get at this point is a better focus and discussion and better research direction for how we can understand the interrelationship between these basic perceptual cognitive building blocks and what that the implication of building those might be in terms of giving you a tool that we haven't had before, and that is building better brains for you to put content into.
Could I elaborate a little bit with the concept of executive function? Our schools don't generally focus on teaching students how to monitor their own learning and do it effectively. In fact, for kids with disabilities or kids who are dumb, it's just the opposite. We teach them a kind of shame, and that they're not going to be able to do what they're supposed to do. I work with a school in New England that specifically focuses with kids with dyslexia on teaching them how they learn effectively, what problems they have, how they can advocate for themselves. And the result first off, 100% of them pass the statewide tests, but then, they go to college and they go to their teachers and they say, I have dyslexia and I want to learn in this course, and so here's what my problems are and here's how you can help me. Proactive approach to dealing with your own, executive processes. It seems to me to be one of the essential things that we could add to our educational system that would make a whole lot of our students more effective learners.
Is somebody who'd been waiting to ask a question almost in the next building?
Yes, hi. My comment is on the repeated instruction. I'm an educational therapist at the Encinitas Learning Center, and I have the opportunity to work one-on-one with kids, and I can speak for all the people that who do work with children with learning disabilities that technique does in fact work over time. when we do have the agility to take the time to repeat those basic skills, we have noticed over time that there is significant improvement because we have the ability to take the time. Thanks.
And so you had a question.
Bill Cody, a former commissioner of education in a couple of states, and the last one was Kentucky. Just to provide an illustration of a policy problem that still persists in a lot of places that could be well informed by the research on spacing and forgetting. And it's the remediation issue of colleges and universities, and students are admitted and a high percentage of the kids are tested in the first month of their freshman year and concluding that none of them know how to do algebra. And they're all required to take an algebra course for non-credit and pay for it, by the way. And this huge dollars are invested in this. On the sort of practice side of struggling with that, the typical response that I advocated and carried forward in two different states was, well, let's just increase the math requirement in high school for graduation. And so we, in both Louisiana and then later in Kentucky, went from 3 years of math required to 2 years of, from 2 years to 3 years in high school. And in Kentucky, those 3 years had to include at least to the level of geometry. And the percent of remediation students didn't change at all. That's what it amounted to. A meeting with a group of math professors, I said, well, this really should maybe it'll take some time, but should make a difference. And they said, but Dr. Cody, the students have already studied the advanced math. And we began to piece together what was going on, and we needed additional data. But the time we increased the requirements for mathematics in terms of high school, during the high school years, also because of some kids are so ambitious, so their parents are, began to take algebra in the eighth grade, satisfying a high school diploma requirement, taking another course of math in their freshman year, a second course of high school math in their second year, no mathematics in their junior and senior year, going into a university, and we began to talk about just-in-time learning, and it's, you know, it's too late, or use it or lose it. Yeah. But how to address that in terms of, well, typically many states, by the way, have gone to 4 years of math, and I have no doubt that many of those kids are starting those requirements in the eighth grade, so they're still going through their senior year, not studying mathematics. Yeah. But how to address that in terms of what's the most appropriate time of second teaching? I still don't know the answer to that. Now, I've been out for 7 or 8 years, so maybe that's been solved by some other places. But I see that kind of research could certainly help what is a major public policy. I mean, schools, individually, systems, and states, with all kinds of improvement plans going on and still getting beat over the head by the, results, when the kids show up. It was, I don't know, you can't realize how good that made me feel to say they were probably taught it, they just didn't remember it.
So how routinely do you find your work, yourselves being invited into or collaborating with school systems?
Well,
with?
We have had a collaboration here at the Proy School on the campus here at UCSD, in which we've been looking at taking a high school history course and adding a review at on the content taught in the course, and then looking at 6 month follow up, and we find our results are sort of echoed in that. So it certainly shows it's not peculiar to the laboratory, what we're finding. But our work's just coming out now, so it's sort of early to know. I think there's a lot of tricky questions about how to rationalize the timing of a lot of things in schools based on this kind of work, and I think that's just beginning, really.
Go ahead.
Yeah, regarding learning something for the second time.
Michael, hi.
My name is Mike Alston. I'm a parent and an engineer. Could the second time around be useful as a teacher if you were teaching a younger sibling or younger students, middle school teachers, students teaching elementary school students? Is that a good way to reinforce a concept and remember it for a long time?
I would think so. I would assume that.
There's data from the Montessori system that works very well. The traditional Montessori system has children in the same classroom for 2 or 3 years. So you first go in, let's say, as a four-year-old. Then as a five-year-old, you're now helping to teach the four-year-olds. It does two wonderful things for the five-year-olds. One is it reinforces what they've learned, and two, it makes them feel so good and so proud. because they're now the teacher who knows, and they get to tell the four-year-old. And it's also true that young children pay much more attention to children who are slightly older than them than they do to adults. So it also is a very helpful teaching aid for the younger child.
I would say a general principle would be learning takes a long time. This is one instance of it, but there are many others. Performance involves kind of practice, requires practice and tuning. Even Tiger Woods, if he doesn't play golf for a year, is not going to play as well. So we need to think about learning as not something that we just get and then we have it, but rather as something that's a skill that we need to practice and master and tune up.
But this question wasn't just about relearning. It's about teaching. And think about the difference between your passively learning what anybody said and you're having to explain it or teach it to somebody else. You learn it so much better when you have to be the one saying it and explaining it. So the older child teaching the younger is not simply going over the same material again, not simply relearning, but now they're actively using it and actively having to explain it. It's a great experience.
If I can make a comment, I think a very important lesson on Hall's work to make us think about is the fact that these phenomena were actually known for hundreds of years, but nobody had taken the time to generalize them to the time scale where they actually were useful from a practical point of view. So the question is, why did it take so long for that to happen? For somebody to go ahead and do a study that involves, you know, realistic timescales. What does it tell us about science and the way the science is organized and its relationship to education?
I wanted to ask Javier, I wanted to follow up on some of Javier's observations in terms of the difference between laboratory research that has an intention of having an impact on education and actually implementing education in the classroom. So I'd like to open the discussion on that, because that certainly has also been my experience, just a transformation in my own understanding of what really it's going to take to interact with schools and understand their systems and their constraints and their barriers to change and in a practical and real sense, and also what it's going to take to get something that might work in a laboratory setting to actually work and scale up across multiple settings in schools is a really big issue that there's very little research on at all. And so I think that that's one of the things that this panel and maybe this whole, one of my goals for this whole town hall would be to begin to think about what might be the differences. I mean, we're not talking about taking a chemical, putting it into the form of a pill, and everyone can just take that same pill and all you have to deal with is compliance. I mean, there really is a whole different system. And what would the, we might need a real discussion about what kinds of controls, as Javier said, they are really different, in my opinion, than the kind of controls we use in laboratory settings to make it real.
Yeah, so this is a question for Paulo Talal and probably Javier Movellán as well, and it's actually related to what you just said. You showed that kids which have a little impairment on the timing task have problems learning to speak, so you might think that it would be better to target the cognitive training to really young kids that are probably don't want to sit down in front of a computer or engage in a task in that sense. So I wonder, how would you implement a task like this in really young kids?
Well, first of all, I'd like to clarify, I no longer think of this as an impairment, just individual differences like height and weight. Certainly there may be many reasons, including a biological difference in some children that would make them end up on the far end of the continuum in terms of being slow, or on the fast end of the continuum in terms of being fast. But I really have changed my own views in terms of whether there's some big cutoff. So I just wanted to clarify that. Certainly being able to start early would be great. It would be great. I mean, we see that the infants are actually able to perform tasks, and the question would be, how would you scale that up? But there's no indication that we have an age effect, on the other hand. So you have many children in high school, and, I mean, even John Cochran is an adult, who are able to benefit from these kinds of approaches. So I think that it's very interesting that there is not an age effect in terms of neuroplasticity. But there might be a social effect of, you know, precluding children from suffering, you know, if we could get to them earlier.
But he talked about whether you can get young children to sit in front of the computer. So maybe you could
That's where the collaboration with someone like Javier would come in, because it's just a matter of being creative about what it is that would attract children. And certainly what Javier is able to do with 2- and 3-year-olds, perhaps married to the kinds of procedures that we've been developing. And I should make it very clear that our procedures are much different than just, you know, quote unquote, speeding up the rate of processing. It is memory control, attentional control, enhancing cognitive skills, and it's just a model. It could be used for just about anything. You marry that with techniques that work better for young children, like the techniques you're using as well, and then it can be very powerful.
Well, go ahead.
Is to say that one of the things we're finding is how important the social interaction is, and how important it is to be able, at this age at least, to have, you know, systems that can able to replicate the type of social interaction that we see between the children and other children, and between the children and adults. And I should also say, when we first started this project, we had no idea how long we were going to be able to maintain the type of interaction that happened with between children and technology. And in fact, the first time that we went there, I remember that after 5 or 10 minutes, the children pretty much left the room, and they were not interested at all. And the teachers were very kind to us, and they say, well, you know, they don't have a large attention span. And, you know, this year now, you know, we learn a lot. And by now, the problem is that maybe, you know, they like the robot too much. So that also tells you about being careful about, you know, explaining things too early, explaining things away. And how important also is to embed yourself in the situation where you want technology to operate.
We also found we were really, I absolutely didn't think that children, even 4 or 5-year-olds, would be able to interact with the computer exercises. And especially parents who come in with kids with attention deficit and say, there's no way they're going to do this. But if they're interactive enough and they're building the systems that you're talking about, I mean, one of the things that we can say is that you feel a lot less shame making a mistake, and, you know, when you're interacting with your computer than you do with a teacher or an adult or your parent or a peer or whatever. So there are other advantages that are perhaps socially beneficial to being able to learn, improve in the drill level, you know, with a computer versus someone who's going to go, nope, that's wrong, whatever. Or the kid.
Now we had a couple of, there's one over there.
Thank you. I'm speaking as a parent again, and hopefully I would like to give the response of a child regarding the image that you said. If you put an image in, it sort of validates it. What those images have done have given children hope, because you've made the invisible visible. They are no longer having to deal with the shame of becoming being called lazy and stupid. They are able to show their peers and validate that there is a neurobiological difference. I have to thank you as a parent. Going away from the definition of learning disabilities, in saying that there is a neurobiological basis to a learning disability, and that there is the cognitive function. This has means so much to children. I volunteer in a pull-out classroom of 15 children with severe learning disabilities. This means so much to them. And when I can show them the concrete of the statistical analysis of our language for, you know, just the incidence of open and closed vowels, et cetera, that we've got from research, and them being able to use an engaging computer program to develop their skills and practice, it's all that's coming, and it's hopeful. And I thank everybody for what you're doing, because it's important to the children, because they understand these pictures that you're giving them?
I think we could take that somewhat further in that now the conceptions of learning disabilities are really quite different from what they used to be. The old model was basically there's a hole in the brain, mm-hmm. And now we see instead there's a continuum of abilities and disabilities that all of the main things that we call learning disabilities are part of the normal distribution, and typically they're associated with processing strengths as well as processing weaknesses. So, for example, there's a growing amount of research that some of which we're doing that indicates that many dyslexics have special visual talents for looking at wide areas of visual span and putting the information together. So, for example, astrophysicists looking at star fields have an advantage sometimes when they're dyslexic because they can see patterns in star fields that non-dyslexics can't because they have more sensitivity in their peripheral visual field, though less in their foveal. So that results in difficulties with reading because of the less foveal sensitivity, but advantages in star fields because of the greater peripheral sensitivity. And I think there are going to be a lot of other things discovered like that as we really get down to figuring out what's going on with learning disabilities.
Hi, Nancy Farnan. Two quick comments. One, I think in education we have long believed and known that development was a factor in learning. And we say it, and we say it, and we say it, and then we work in systems that acknowledge it not at all. And that's a definite problem that I don't think is unsolvable, but we teach everyone the same curriculum at the same time and test them on the same day, and then are surprised that we get results that may or may not be all that wonderful regarding our students. So that's a system problem. And then Paula made a comment about working together, working in classrooms, working, and maybe the term is translational research. Maybe there's another term, because we have models, we call them professional development schools, and you're working with Preuss. The professional development school model is bringing the schools and the universities together to explore what is interesting to all of us and focuses absolutely on student achievement. But I don't know of any particular instance where that collaborative has involved the brain researchers. And so I don't know if it's translating research from one place to another or it's collaborating on systems and knowledge and experiences so that we can make better systems of learning for children. So I think there should be a good term for that.
In the Mind, Brain, and Education Society, we're trying to promote those kinds of relationships. We've got things going with a couple of schools where neuroscientists, cognitive neuroscientists, are actually working with the schools, and we're calling them research schools, kind of just a notch away from what Dewey used to call lab schools. And the idea is exactly what you're saying, to have a real interaction between educators and scientists, where the educators are influencing the scientists as much as the scientists are influencing the educators. The way Javier talked about it, that's the way it has to go. You know, it's been happening in medicine for a long time. It has not been happening in education. And the best way for us to improve educational research is to have to move over to this model where the educators are actually helping to formulate the questions, helping to adjust the methods so that they can actually work in school settings.
Well, during the day, we have talked about the cognitive systems in the brain, the emotional systems in the brain, the intuitive and the processing systems, the physical movement. And we found in our application research that the integration of those systems in every single lesson was very, very powerful. And I had not heard that today and wanted to be sure that everyone was aware it is not only possible, the children understand it far better than each one separately or the focus that we have had on that separation. And when we integrate them, the power is astounding.
I'd like to just second that. Paula talked earlier about integrating the perceptual and cognitive and how they're really very much interrelated and part and parcel of one another. And the motor is also completely in that mix. Mm-hmm. So that children who have a so-called learning disorder, whether it's ADHD or autism or dyslexia, about half of them fit the diagnosis for developmental discoordination disorder. About half the kids with developmental discoordination disorder also have cognitive learning problems. When you look at neuroimaging, prefrontal is considered a cognitive area. Cerebellum has traditionally been considered a motor area. But whenever you see prefrontal activation increase, you always see cerebellar activation increase. And whenever you see prefrontal activation go down, you see cerebellar activation go down. All the laws of learning, like the spacing effect, spacing versus mass practice, that apply to cognitive learning, apply absolutely equally to motor learning. They're absolutely intertwined together. So it's not just perceptual and cognitive, it's perceptual, cognitive, and motor, absolutely.
Yeah. And so, emotional.
Yeah, go ahead.
I'm sorry, just to add, you can even say that the emotional aspects in some ways ride on the body. I mean, that's what I was starting to present. I didn't go into depth, but actually what I would have said if I'd had more time is that the network that is used to sort of admire people doing skillful activations, you know, skillful activities like playing basketball or solving a Rubik's Cube blindfolded, right? Really amazing activities, you actually recruit parietal areas that have to do with spatial integration and moving your own body and musculoskeletal system. I mean, the knowledge about the skills rides on your own ability to locate your own body in space and use your body. I mean, these things are absolutely intertwined. You're totally right to try to intertwine them in educational experiences. Yeah.
In addition, of course, you get children more engaged if you have the whole self there participating.
Yeah, I think at this point we have to take our whole selves outside for the coffee. A little coffee. Thank you for this panel. Can we come back in 15 minutes?